are out and about walking, going through your day, and suddenly feel a sense of gladness, there's a high possibility that you have just received a kiss that was blown to you by me. My name is Swan, and I'm blowing you kisses from the basement of the Velo Bike Shop in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and my show is Ink and Worm, all things reading and writing. Today we're going to explore the creative process with two wonderful, interesting people. My first guest is Lyndall Descant. I don't know why sometimes I get flustered with names. You are a Brooklyn-based musician, writer, artist, among a multitude of other things. Welcome.
Thank you.
And your friend Lawson Leong is Brooklyn-based stand-up comedian, and you said you're launching your first, like, solo show. Is that what I saw on the internet?
It was a comedy special that I released in August of last year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, looking. I didn't look at dates, obviously. Whoops. Well, thanks for coming, guys, and being here. We're just going to talk books. My show's, you know, about the words that have shaped us.
Cool.
And we'll just dive right in to a project you have been working on and actively working on or inactively based on life for about 12 years now. Is that correct?
Yeah. I guess active and inactive, sort of going through rest and repose at times and giving up on it and then picking it back up.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been teaching children. When I started the book 12 years ago, I was in education, but I wasn't actually teaching or interacting with children.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the book, and then I just sort of, I was speaking with Lawson about on the way here, I kept changing it as my ideas were changing about things, like what really I wanted to say with it. And then I sort of set it aside and really started studying music and interacting with children on a daily basis. So I feel like even though I wasn't actually writing it,
mm-hmm.
I was sort of working through the processes of how to speak with children and what I really wanted to say to them. And so it's sort of always been in the back of my mind for the last 12 years. And I'm really happy to be at the point where I decided, okay, this is it. The edits are done. This is where it's at. And now going to the step of sharing it with people and getting it out in the world.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about that process of, like, you know, self-publishing just to push it out there versus finding an agent who's willing to represent the book and help you clean it up even more or whatever.
Exactly.
And that's quite a process for anyone. So it's incredible. I'm impressed that you have a thing that's, like, ready for that level. That's just, like, a huge thing in and of itself, is to, you know, follow a project through completion and then go over it enough times that it's ready, you know. And
Thank
I love
you.
The format of your book, because it's almost like a chapter book, but for children.
Yeah.
Like, it's broken down into, I guess, different scenes and chapters. I really liked that.
Thank you.
Was it always, like, a longer, more chapter-like thing in your mind?
Yeah, it sort of started out that I tend to think out of the box in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, you know, what is sort of accepted as children's books and how things should work, but my mind just doesn't think that way. And I was really affected by a book that I read when I was young called Hope for the Flowers by Trina Paulus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys have read this book.
I don't know.
I would highly recommend it as a children's book, and she had it as a chapter book as well.
Yeah.
Even though I think it was, you know, less words and more illustration than mine, but had it as a chapter book. And I, at this point, as a music teacher, I teach all ages of children, and one of the things that I find that all of them love is to sort of be treated like they're older than they are.
Mm-hmm.
They love it. Like, one of the worst things you can do is called a child, like, a, you know, a 4 or 5 year old, to even a 10 year old, a baby. Like, they just feel so much older than, like, an 8 year old or, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that one of the things that I've gravitated towards is a methodology that treats them with respect and, you know, sort of honors them and doesn't necessarily talk down to them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's things in my book that sort of mean to do that, sort of, you know.
Yeah.
Enable them to feel powerful.
I mean, and even though kids are small, they are processing some complex emotions, and you touch on that in your story. Do you want to tell us a little about the plot?
Sure. So it's about a little girl who gets cast as the lead in the school play of The Ugly Duckling. And the book really starts at the moment that night after she received it, and it's what she wanted, and she was so happy. But it's sort of like the other children kind of turned on her a little bit, and she was sort of feeling ostracized for actually getting what she wanted and starts to doubt that she can do this and that she even wants to do this. And so she, the book sort of starts with her dealing with the anxieties, performance anxiety mainly, but also dips into the fact that she's somebody who already at a young age, and I see this a lot with the children I work with, especially in Brooklyn, have a perfectionist side to them. And it's sort of like if they don't, if they're not assured it's going to be perfect, they don't even want to touch it. And to me, that's very detrimental to the creative process and to the learning process.
Yeah, I think at, most times in order to create, you have to step into the opposite state of mind, letting go of control and letting it be the worst thing ever if it if that's what it is, you know?
Exactly.
And then it gets better from there.
Yeah, exactly. It's a process, and if you stop yourself before that process can be started, then, you know, it's essentially cutting off that creative side to yourself, that imagination. So the book then sort of follows her as she uses her dreams that night as a means to learn how to trust in herself and her abilities and just trust in general that even if it is terrible, she'll make it through it. Whatever it is, she's going to trust and face the reality that this is an opportunity she can't pass up.
I forgot to tell you this, but I love the fact that she is cast as the lead in the play The Ugly Duckling. I just think that's so great. And so, like, I just, the mixed feelings that would go with like being the lead.
You're perfect for this
of
part.
That type of thing. It's I just love that about it.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is this this book I wrote it so long ago that some of the elements of it I don't remember actually how they came about, but the truth is that actually comes from my life. Like I was actually cast as the Ugly Duckling in second grade
were?
Play. Yeah.
Oh. So in a second grade you said?
In second grade.
Awesome. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense.
The lead?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And were you nervous?
Was I what?
Nervous?
Definitely, I was nervous.
So, in a way, it's reconnecting to that childhood self, and in a way, you're, like, self-soothing years and years later.
Exactly. Like, that's exactly what this book really was about, because I dealt with massive performance anxiety, even into being an adult, and it really did stop me a lot of the time. And there was also another side to me that was very inquisitive, thought about a lot of things that nobody would speak about or talk to me about at the time. And so I promised myself as a young girl that as when I was an adult, I would write a book that I would have wanted to read. And so that's sort of when I started this book, that was the main thing I was doing was fulfilling a promise to myself. And so it's largely about soothing that little girl.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think that's true of many writers. They end up writing the books that they've wanted and didn't have. And I think especially that's true when it comes to children's books because there's so much out there, but there's also, you know, complex subject matter that isn't tackled in children's books, like performance anxiety or, you know, being insecure about something good happening. I mean, kids have that emotion, like they have those emotional responses too. So I think those are the most poignant books are the ones that that like straight on tackle something that's a little bit more challenging emotionally for kids. Anyways,
I agree.
And do you want to talk a little bit about, because you created a whole thing. It has a song, it has illustrations, and you wrote all the text. Do you want to talk about like the different processes that you're, the mediums that you're using to tell the story?
Sure. Because like I mentioned, a lot of my creative side did get shut down when I was young from a you know, for various reasons. And in my early 20s, I moved to Austin and I started to slowly open up to all of them. And the first thing was painting. And it was just something that I just knew I was only going to do for myself after I was done with work. And it was a way to keep my sanity. And then I think the next thing that came was writing. And then the next thing was music. And then it was like, after all these years of suppressing that creativity, it was just bursting out of me. And so then as I started to get involved with children, and just being in the education system, I also wanted this book to be a little bit like supplemental education. And I feel like the arts are just, you know, more and more disappearing from the mainstream, you know, school system. So, and I was working in textbooks at the time, and so I was dealing with all the concrete subjects, and this wasn't being addressed at all. So I also wanted to inspire through my own, just more by example, like, listen, it doesn't have to be perfect. Just create. It feels mm-hmm. so good to create. And writing, painting, photography, and music are my main ways. And so I tried to put all of those in this book. And ultimately, the book I hope encourages children to search for their own passions, what they love. Mm-hmm. But I think I particularly, because I'm more of the artist vein, and also because I feel like it's missing more from what children are exposed to mm-hmm. on a daily basis, that's why this book has those. And so I have a song that goes with it that I also included on a my latest CD that I'm about to release at the end of the month.
Yay!
So it's kind of, for me, all of it interrelates. They, all of my disciplines, all the different art forms I do feed into each other.
Yeah.
And so that's, this project is like that. I guess it's multidimensional.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And you've been showing it to friends and getting feedback. And I'm assuming you read it. Do you want to share your thoughts, your experience?
Yeah, I really liked it. It is, one of the things I thought when I was reading it is that it's a more, I don't want to say it's a more difficult read, but it is like, it's a more involved read mm-hmm. than most children's books.
It's not like a 5 minute before bed.
No, mm-hmm. yeah. There's one of my favorite comedians, Brian Regan, has a joke about mm-hmm. how he wants to get into the children's book writing industry because he thinks it'd be super easy. You just open a book and be like, there was a clock. The clock rang. The end. And that's like the whole thing. But like, but like Lindell's book is so much, it warrants like rereading. Like, I had to read it. It's a children's book, and I had to, like, read it twice.
Yeah.
Because just, like, I feel like there was more to get out of it. So I think children are going to want to read it over and over again. It has, like, a lot of rereadability, if that's a word. It probably
yeah,
isn't.
Yeah, it's a concept. There are books that definitely, like, you're not through digesting them the first time you read it. You have to reread mm-hmm. in order to feel like you're processing everything that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the... You have a strong theme of nature that comes throughout the book, and that's something that really spoke to me, you know, being more comfortable outdoors than indoors typically. It just was like, yeah.
Yeah.
So just complimenting you on that,
oh, thank
including
you.
That angle, like dreamscape, but also like, you know, I think that nature is an access point to creativity.
I agree.
Just like having that contact with the natural world.
Yeah. And also, I think it's good because it unlocks, like, I know growing up as a kid, I mean, this might be a very male perspective, but you get, like, shamed for being, I don't know, like, allowing yourself to be, like, too connected with nature because there's something
really?
About it that's, like, not
I think
cool.
masculine.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to explain, really, but, yeah, that book really, like, it plays up the importance of being in tune with nature. I guess, because I guess it's, yeah.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, depending on, like, what area you're from, there's, yeah, I think as a man you can be discouraged from, like...
Yeah.
Being
like,
sensitive.
Tree hugger is, like,
I
such
a
shameful
I think it's
thing.
A sensitivity thing of just yeah. being, like, sensitive to,
mm-hmm.
rather than be like, ants, I'm going to step on them versus...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, burning
yeah.
them with
yeah.
whatever, magnifying glasses or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it's that part of the book is just something that came out really natural. I really love trees.
Mm-hmm.
So trees are an essential part of this book, and it's also where the title comes from, Masters of Trust. That's what it's referring to as trees. And I feel like that message, that part of the book is only becoming more and more important
mm-hmm.
these days mm-hmm. as we're sort of facing some of the polarization going on in society. But, you know, the preservation of nature, the value of nature, what it does for us as human beings, I don't think can be understated. And I think mm-hmm. children know this. I think they're sort of taught not to
mm-hmm.
value
mm-hmm.
nature.
Yeah.
So this totally. Book is, that part of the book is understated more because I think that that's a way actually to build rapport with children. They sort of
mm-hmm.
all get that,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, for the most part.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Until they're taught not to.
Yeah, society builds this disconnect with nature. But kids are definitely more comfortable, I think, romping around in the dirt.
Yeah.
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 Let's talk about your journey for a moment. You're a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
Have you always been, like, the funny guy in school, or...?
not till high school.
Yeah.
Probably. When I was, like, 15, 16. And yeah, so I was super shy when I was younger. When I was in high school, there was something, I think what I loved about comedy was that comedians were always the people that seemed to be, like, question things a lot. And I had I struggled a lot with, like, religion growing up. So comedians were, like, so cynical about religion, and that meant something to me because I didn't know that I was allowed to be until I was, like, a teenager. So, yeah, I really it's weird, though, because since then I've come all the way back around where now I'm really in tune with religion. Like, maybe not, religion, but at least spirituality and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what really got me into it, just the nature of, like, questioning things. And also, you know, it's fun. It's just fun to be funny.
Yeah.
It's just
you
like,
make
it's
people
fun.
Laugh.
Yeah. It's just something.
Or you don't, and then you're like, okay, that didn't work.
But even that's, like, funny sometimes, and it can be fun. Like, especially when you're with your friends.
Yeah.
Like, there's lots of times where I'm, like, trying to make something funny, and then it's not. But me trying too hard becomes what's
then
funny.
Then you have to, like,
it.
Overkill it because it didn't work. Like,
yeah.
It didn't go off smoothly, so you're, like, drawing more attention to the
yeah.
fact that you're, like, but do you see what I was trying to do there?
Yeah.
Like, see how that could have been funny?
Yeah. Like, I was just, like, a week I was hanging out with a bunch of my friends who were comedians, and it was, like, a board game night. I just kept trying to make a bear, like, a joke about the Revenant, because there was a bear. So I just kept trying to make, and it never landed all night. And then my friend's like, why do you keep trying to make this a thing? And I was like, because I have to. Because if I don't try to make it funny, then my heart won't be singing. Like, it makes me happy to try. That's, otherwise, I won't be true to myself if I don't try to make it a thing, so.
And you mentioned Brian Regan, who was a very funny, I definitely appreciate him and saw him live a couple times. And I love, like, the physical nature of his acts, too, like, just the facial expressions and the postures that he does throughout his show. Are there other comedians that have, like, influenced you in the way that you approach it?
I think Brian Regan is the funniest comedian I've ever seen.
And he's so clean,
too. Yeah. But
anybody can listen to him.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't think he influenced me even a little bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but he's just I think he is the funniest, just purely just funniest comedian I've ever seen. But my favorites are George Carlin. And I love Louis C.K., but now, like, everyone does, so I don't feel as cool when I say it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I've always loved Louis. Louis is so great. Bill Hicks, Doug Stanhope rubs a lot of people the wrong way because he's a man riddled with vices, and he's very caustic.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got such a great mind. But George Carlin's always been my favorite.
Yeah.
But he was the guy that made me go, I could never do comedy. Because he's just too good. I couldn't do that. But now
so
I want
to. When did that change? When were you like, okay, I can't do what he is doing, but you could do your thing? Was there like a experience?
Mitch Hedberg,
or a moment?
Weirdly. I started as a one-liner comic.
Uh-huh.
Mitch Hedberg was a. I don't know how many people know who he is. He died in 2005, though, tragically young. But he was a one-liner comic. And he was, I loved what he did, and I thought I could do that. I could write one-liners, you know, but it's actually harder than you think when you start doing it.
Yeah.
But it's what got me into the game. And now that I've been in it for a while, I totally want to do what, like, George Carlin did and Bill Hicks and all those guys. And Louis, Louis's comedy so empathetic. I love that about him.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about not dodging around matters of the heart and the human experience. He's like,
yeah.
And you're like, oh yeah.
Yeah. He gets right to the heart of things.
Yeah. And he's not shy to go there and go deeper, which is always nice. I just remember this, something standing out in my memory is a skit he did about cell phones and about how people are addicted to their cell phones because it soothes that feeling of being alone. Because if you're like, I'm lonely, let me check my phone. And he's like, sometimes I don't, and I just sit with being alone because we're all gonna die anyways. Like, he just, like, takes it really deep. He's like, so we might as well get used to the fact that we are really essentially alone, and sometimes it's okay to, like, feel alone.
Yeah.
Just like, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, how people are completely glued to their phones, and it just has changed our society in such interesting ways. Like,
and so it's the go-to if you're like at a party, but you're not talking to anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
For like the 30 seconds, you weren't talking to somebody.
It's really funny to watch.
I don't want anyone to know that I'm a loser.
Yeah, I've got people talking to me. It's just on my phone.
Yeah, no,
I'm so popular.
So many friends.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And I love watching drunk people on their phones because they'll like do the same thing like 12 times, and you're like.
Yeah.
I've done that. I've been like at a party and been like over there like deleting junk mail.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's just like the most urgent thing I've ever
done. You're like, I gotta clean my inbox. Yeah.
Just doing busy work.
Like,
yeah.
You know, let me know when the pizza comes.
Yeah.
No, it's true. And that's one of the reasons that I like, that's the vein of stand-up comedy that I like when they're like Lawson's saying, like they're pointing things out to us, the heart of the matter of the human condition, but they're doing it in a funny way so that
you
feel
can laugh
so
at it, but you're also like, but wait, I do that.
And I think it does connect us all. And one of the first, we were talking about the first time I heard Lawson, because we actually met at Bar 4. Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear about Bar 4?
No, I didn't.
It was this great spot that, like, was in Brooklyn for many, many years. I don't know how long, like 10 years?
At least a decade, yeah.
And they had an open mic every Tuesday night, and it was the most incredible gathering of musicians and comedians.
Yeah.
Every Tuesday night. And when I first got to Brooklyn, I lived around the corner from it, so I ended up there, and that's why I first heard Lawson's comedy.
Ah.
And I started calling him the metaphysical comedian in my head, because it was like he went to the heart of the matter every time, and sometimes it would make everybody so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's what I love. Like, and then you would end up being like so uncomfortable, but somehow laughing through it all, and it, you know, you felt kind of healed by that process somehow, I think.
Yeah. I like that. That makes me wish.
I hope that was true.
That I saw you. You'll have to let me know when you're doing a show again, and I can post it to my listeners and then also show up, because it sounds like something I would appreciate.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah.
I want to talk about the performance nature of what you guys do. You work with words, and so you're, you know, editing and moving things and making it work. But then at the end of, like, the process, sometimes, but you're presenting something, you're performing something. It is, I don't know, do you want to talk about like how things translate and don't translate from like playing with words versus like performing words?
Oh, that's good.
I think what's interesting about books is that it's so like you can't, unless you're like literally reading the book to somebody, you can't read a book for somebody. So everybody who's reading a book, you always read a book in your own voice. Unless you just decided that this is how this character sounds for some reason.
Yeah.
You know? If you just already... Like, maybe the kids who read Harry Potter after the movies...
Heard
like,
the
read
kids.
Snape and Alan Rickman's voice.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you're going to read everything in your voice. And so that's got to influence the way... What you bring to the book, which I think is interesting. Where, as opposed to, like, performing where it's your voice.
Listening, you're hearing.
Yeah.
And as a performer, you're the one, like... Bringing the conversation up,
to
I guess.
Them, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it feels, for me, I'm a little bit shy. So I think I feel a little bit safer, creating words in a book and having time to rearrange them and make sure they're saying the right thing, as opposed to like right now just speaking on the fly and not being able to edit what comes out of my mouth.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit more faith for me, a little bit more courage to do that. And it's a little bit more of the same things that I'm still dealing with that my little girl was dealing with.
Yeah.
You know, the performance anxiety of, like, just letting it go and not controlling it.
Mm.
So it's thrilling in that way. And I love spontaneity and the improvisation of it. But I think at the end of the day, for me, it feels more comfortable to be in my own space, in my own room, writing these words out or thinking through these things. I almost sometimes imagine there coming a time when I retire from performing altogether and then just more focus.
Hide and put words out.
What?
Hide from the world and put words out.
Yeah, hide somewhere in nature.
That's an interesting thing as a writer, figuring out my process is, the way that things come up off the page. So, you know, I'll do work longhand and then I'll put, like, transcribe it to my computer and then I'll edit it and then I'll print it and be like, how did I not catch these glaring things on the computer screen? It's just like, interacting with the paper, you're like, oh, this is like a different experience than, I don't know, brainstorming or editing on a computer. And that's something that really helped my process get cleaner. Mm. But also that editing thing, I think there's a lot of power in that ability to edit. I think that's something a lot of writers struggle with. They love the ability to make it perfect before, like, releasing it versus just, like, on the fly, being put on the spot, you know, and having and losing that ability, I guess.
I think it could also I think it's also a double-edged sword, mm-hmm. because I know that's why I've sat on this book for 12 years, is because I was, like, continually re-editing it and then realizing that the edit was almost in a trend of where I was at, and it wasn't at the core of the book. I kept editing for trends that were going on.
Like what you were doing with your life right then.
Right then in that moment. Mm-hmm. And it kept changing, and then I'd have to, like, kind of, like, go back. And that was why I realized, I think that there is what I've learned from performance I bring to this process, because there is a certain point where you just got to be like, it's good enough, and this is it, and this is the essence. Mm-hmm. of what I'm trying to say, and let the rest go. And then sometimes that's the best part of it, because something that in your own mind didn't seem perfect actually was what connected it to something else or a mm-hmm. bigger picture that you weren't even aware of, I think. Mm-hmm.
Nice. The audience is going to give you the thing. Editing is, like, obviously very helpful, but the thing about performing is the audience is going to give you more of the benefit of the doubt because they know that it's happening right now and that they can't do anything about it.
Yeah, that immediacy is there.
Yeah, so I think there's different, like, levels that the audience is going to give you. Whereas, like, something that's already been edited, they're going to expect it to be, you know, more perfect, maybe.
Like, maybe less tolerant of the errors that, happen.
Yeah.
Interesting. Makes me... I'm just kind of sitting with that idea of, like, interacting with something as a reader versus interacting with something as, like, an audience member. Mm-hmm. And what are the parallels and the differences? It's a curious concept because I feel like both are a type of conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really fascinating to see what you react to, and especially in the world of comedy. Like, if somebody says something and you're offended, I think that's, like, a really good opportunity to, like, be like, wait, why... why am I offended by that? Why did that, like, trigger something in me?
Yeah.
And then, obviously, you know, a talented comedian will make you laugh about it, and you heal. Like, whatever was happening that you were like, oh, I'm very uncomfortable. Okay, I feel better.
Like, yeah. For sure.
You mentioned some of the influences as you were becoming, you know, figuring out comedian. My computer keeps trying to update, sorry. What about you? Were there influences? I know that part of the catalyst of you even beginning the book was traveling. Mm-hmm. Was there other influences that you were, like, drawn to as you were finding your voice, your mediums?
That's a really good question. I think most of probably the biggest influence, and this could maybe sound cliche a little bit, but is Phish, the band Phish.
Ah.
Because it was, I sort of had an awakening in my early 20s. Up until that point, I was pretty shut down. And there was a lot of things that were happening for me at once. But it was the improvisation of Phish and the way that if you ever, like, follow them, you see that some shows are absolute flops. Mm-hmm. And they live with that risk. And I think I've even heard Nora Jones talk about that. And she was an early influence for me in my 20s. Because I also wanted to play piano and sing, and there wasn't that many artists in the vein that I was looking for or that I was interested in. And so these people were showing me that it wasn't perfect. They were never sure that it was perfect, but they were getting on stage and taking the risk every night. And I think that was the thing that gave me the courage or the inspiration to say, like, I don't care what this is for me, but I know, kind of like with Lawson, if my heart's going to sing, I have to at least try.
Yeah. This is good for me to hear right now, I think, because I have signed up to do a, like, performance art thing in the next Bushwick Book Club.
Ooh.
And I don't feel like I've performed in a while, so I'm having some, like, oh, God, like, what am I going to do? What if it's not perfect? Like, what if people hate it? And it's really interesting because it does, like, I think all of the demons you're living with now are the same demons you had as a, like, a kid. I mean, I look back at being a vulnerable kid and being made fun of for certain things, and I'm just like, those are the things I'm scared of, and I'm just like, these aren't my classmates. They're gonna, you know, they're gonna be complete strangers that I'm, I don't know, it's just interesting for me to work through my personal fears and triggers.
And what were you performing before?
Well, I have been a while. Yeah, I have this show. I've been in a couple of plays.
Okay.
And then I was a dancer for a few years as a kid.
Okay.
And I think that's about it. I was never musical. I wanted to be, but the practicing was lost on me.
Yeah, it's really hard.
You have to practice before you get good.
Yeah, like do it over and
yeah.
over.
Yeah.
Who could imagine?
I couldn't.
Yeah.
I wanted to just pick up any instrument and be like, bring.
Like, that would be nice.
That would be nice. I wanted to be a prodigy, but alas, it's not to be. So I can either practice something and then, you know, make music. But I was in a band, too, I guess, playing the flute. But you can't really sing and play the flute at the same time.
Yeah.
If I could master that, I would be a big hit.
That would be a very big hit.
You'd get so many hits on YouTube.
I'd be like, look what I can do, circular breathing and speaking and blowing and musical notes. You're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you're just tuning in, you can catch the podcast on Stitcher, iTunes, or Audio Boom next week. And thanks for tuning in. And we're talking to... artist of what was the label you choose? Musician, artist.
I guess I
writer.
Generally say artist because you could be a musician and be considered an artist.
Yeah.
So I generally say artist.
So Lyndall Descant, artist, and Lawson Leong, Brooklyn-based comedian. So mm-hmm. yes.
Yeah.
We're talking a little bit about processes. Is there things that you go about when you're generating new content? Like, do you gather things throughout your days and then sit down and make, like, a thing out of them?
I don't do it consciously anymore. It's weird because my process now is to go on stage and just see what happens.
Wow! That's stepping into fear.
Yeah, like, but that's because I a lot of positive words.
Also, lack of preparation.
Also, you could also say, but part of
and
it.
I'm funny enough that I just make it work.
Also, yeah, maybe confident, maybe overconfident a little bit, but also, it's the only way that it's fun for me anymore because when I first started, I've been doing it long enough that I've done it a lot of different ways. Like when I first started with one-liners, mm-hmm. I wrote everything out and mm-hmm. it had to be perfect down to the pronunciation on the right mm-hmm. syllable. And then it became gradually, and now I just longer jokes, and then I just stopped writing altogether.
Mm.
And so now it's just me talking to the audience. And, I mean, I have jokes I can fall back on.
And there's a presence there, too. I mean, you're, like, with them. It speaks to kind of, we were saying when you were writing your book, you noticed that a lot of your edits were, like, based on your current situation. And I noticed, like, through my writing, different things in my life will trigger different projects. And some of them, you know, are manifest, and some of them are just little notes in my book. But how about you? When you have a CD launching, so... when you're generating a song, perhaps, like, or something similar, what's your, like, process? Do you pull from life and then, like, build it from there?
Yeah, I'm sort of one of these people who's not great at routines, so a lot of times I have many different ways I like variety in life. Like, I like a variety of food, mm-hmm. a variety of my days, and mm-hmm. so I do a creative process in a variety of ways, but I think that the one main way, and it oftentimes does produce the works that are a little bit more durable, or the ones that last or stand the test of the time, is it comes down to writing like a poem. And usually it's in one of two states. I'm in a very emotional, dark, like freaking out kind of place.
Mm-hmm.
And I write something, and it's usually more stream of consciousness type of thing. And then I'll go back 6 months later and realize, like, there's something there.
Yeah.
Or the other option is, like, I'm in nature, or I'm at, I grew up, I was lucky enough to grow up playing on a Yamaha Baby Grand.
Mm-hmm.
And often when I sit on that piano, songs come through. So there's, like, being out in nature, being on that is a more positive way of invoking the same type of experience. It's usually more comes out in one big chunk, and there's not much editing to it. When it comes down to that.
Interesting.
Those are the main ways. But I also journal a lot, and a lot of my ideas come out that way, too.
Mm.
You know, writing about, you know, mundane whatever, stuff that nobody wants to hear me talk about, so I put it in my journal.
Well, that's a... I think there's a lot of value in that. I know that Margaret Atwood is like, you know, write down the details of your life, because 20 years from now, people aren't going to know, you know? It's just like how we have gaps of information from 20 years... in the past, because, you know, all these little details about people's day-to-day life that are mundane and boring, but, like, we no longer have access to that state of mind, that world. So,
mm-hmm.
like,
yeah.
it's important to document.
Yeah. I think I started that with the artist way.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Have you really done that?
That's the one that has the morning papers thing,
mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I did that for, like, a week. It's hard to keep doing it.
It is hard to keep doing.
Yeah, I had such a productive week that week, though. I should probably go back to that.
Well, my thing is when I notice that when I remember my dreams, and that's like my starting point in the morning, mm-hmm. like I'm able to write better. If I just wake up and like I hit snooze 40 times, which sometimes happens, and my dreams are lost, it's harder for me to step into that like flow.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that. I mean, who knows the science behind it, but I think that is one of the keys of the morning pages, is it catches you when you're still unconscious. And so that's just like flows into things. And then your mind starts to step in here and there, and you can see that. But
right.
yeah.
And so do you write your dreams down in the morning when you remember them?
Yeah, I do.
That's something that I would really like to get better at. I've been wanting to get better at that for a while. Because I'd always think, like, after my coffee, I'll write it down.
And then it's
and
gone.
And I forget it.
And then you don't if you don't have, like, a roommate or someone you told, like,
right.
If you have the ability to tell someone, then it sticks. But you can't, like, I guess you could, like, wake up and tell yourself your dream. Or sometimes I'll hold it. And that's the strange thing, too, is, like, you know, I've been wanting to have a dream journal since, like, college, sophomore year, years ago. And I was like, oh, but I don't remember my dreams. I sleep in. And there's all these tricks of like helping you actually connect to your dreams and remember them. And that was one that kind of works for me sometimes, is right when I'm waking up, my alarm went off, whatever, I turned it off and I'm lying there. I'm like, okay, let me make a list of all the details that I can recall. Just in my head. And then when I go to write them, I can be like, okay, I had 14 details. Let me see if I can pull them all back.
Okay.
Like count them. It doesn't work with every dream, but there's some dreams that I have that are really like almost like a film. So it's like zooms in on this thing. And then there's like this sound and this smell or like whatever it is. So I'd be like, I just count them. I'd be like, okay, I have 12 things for my dream that I want to write down. And then I can pull out my notebook and be like, okay, 1, 2, 3. That's something that kind of helped me. And then also there's a lot of power in saying, you know, before you go to bed, I'm going to remember my dreams in the morning and write them down.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I think that's part of what I'd like. I have had some ideas come through dreams before.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I wrote in that book. I just think there's a lot of untapped potential in harnessing our dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've gotten better at it, and I'd like to continue to get better. And I remember being really affected in college reading about, I think it was Margaret Mead did a study of a culture where that was the habit to wake up and talk around the breakfast table of what they all shared dreams every single morning.
Yeah.
And I do think that there's just like a large amount of, I think that's a key to tapping into our imagination or unused potential of our brains.
And I think it's a strange community builder. I mean, I look at where I'm at right now. I'm not really living with people where that's an option. And it's almost something like I dream of having a community where I can be like, and then there was this weird thing that turned into the ocean and like nothing makes sense. But at least I like,
yeah.
I think that's often the thing that happens with dreams, too, is trying to give someone insight, you're like, no, but it was like a monster, but then it wasn't, and it was like a teddy bear, and then I went on a walk, and they're just like, I'm not following. And you're like, no, but like in my dream, it was all like, it made sense.
Yeah, dream rules are all over the place. But it's interesting because since it's your like unconscious subconscious that it, I always get the feeling when I wake up is like, well, what are rules anyway? Like, yeah. if I just was in a place where there were these rules, but they didn't make any sense, then what rules really do? So I don't know. There's something about that to me.
That sounds like a lucid dreamer.
Yeah, that sounds like lucid dreaming.
I lucid dream sometimes.
I've had a couple dreams where, like, I woke up and I swear that really happened.
Oh, yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
For some reason, this makes me think of some meme I saw recently on the internet circulating, and it talks about, it says something to the effect of, you can do anything you want to as soon as you stop telling yourself that you can't. Mm. And so that, I think, also speaks into, like, the affirmations of, like, I'm going to remember my dreams. But in life, in general, like, I forgot the way you put it, but just like doing things because you can. I don't know. You're talking about dreams and you're...
Well, because when you lucid dream, you... have you guys lucid dreamed?
You have... You're like aware of dreaming and you can change things.
I've had two or three. Yeah. Yeah, I guess we should define lucid dreaming.
Have you transitioned that into the thing where... you can just be the god of that world?
Well, there's a... I mean, I can share a really... good example. I was having this dream where I was being chased by an army, and like I ran into this dormitory and hid under a bed, and I was just like, oh my god, they're coming, there's nowhere to go. And then I was like, wait, this is a dream and I can just fly out of here. And so I did.
Yeah, yeah.
But having experiences like that where you're like, this is a dream, how do I want it to end? Right. I'm not gonna get captured by this army.
Yeah.
And that's, I've only done that a couple of times, though. Yeah. There was a time that I was doing affirmations, like I'm gonna lucid dream,
mm-hmm.
and it's sort of like I'll be able to fly and glide in my dreams a lot, but I'm still not entirely aware that it's a dream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not like, but I know.
Yeah. Sometimes dream rules dictate that you can just fly.
Yeah.
It's hard to know that it's a dream sometimes if it's really real.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me. The first time it happened, I was actually 9, and it was because I got shot with a shotgun in my dream.
Oh my gosh.
But I didn't die, because it was a dream, and it was... So I was just like, wait a minute.
I feel like I always have those moments where, like, something happens, and I'm dead in my dream, and I wake up in real life, and I'm like, oh, no, not the way I want to wake up, and not the way I wanted that to end.
Yeah. Like, well, that's the thing with lucid dreaming is you're always, like, this close to waking up, so it's hard to stay there. But that one time when I was 9, I think it was definitely the first time because I was like, wait a minute.
Shot.
If I'm alive, this must be a dream. And then I just like controlled the rest of how the dream went. I don't remember what I did exactly.
Weird.
But it was, yeah. I was 9, so I probably just played dodgeball or something. I was just it's like, well, we're going to play dodgeball now. And I was like, you just got shot. I'm like, whatever.
You're like, not anymore. Look.
It's fine. So, yeah.
I think it's a strange type of meditation, dreaming, because you talked about, like, you're just below the surface of, like, waking up.
Mm-hmm.
I think meditation is holding just below the surface of that constant mind chatter and, like, just getting beneath it so you can look up and watch it go by and not be affected by it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was hanging out with some friends the other night, Tara and John Fannin, and we were talking about the idea of, when you're from your parents and from society, you end up sort of getting this wallpaper in your mind. And this wallpaper is like the thoughts that you're sort of told are reality and this is it. And you don't even really see outside of it or you don't see any other options. And I think that creativity, meditation, dreaming is that other side. It's whatever's on the other side of that wallpaper. And you have to sort of bust through it. And I think whenever we're performing, when we're facing performing or we're facing putting our heart out there and really giving up control as to whether or not we're going to be approved for how we think or feel about something, that wallpaper, for whatever reason, tends to be really, really negative and just coming with the worst possible notion of what could happen if we put ourselves out there and make ourselves vulnerable. But if you bust through it with the courage, like I've seen Lawson do a million times on stage, and just, you don't care, you just bust right through that wallpaper, then it tends to like tap you into this other peaceful state that we're all kind of, I think we would enjoy like walking around and living in most of the time. So I think that, and that's kind of a concept I'm working on. This is an idea that came up with friends, but I'm thinking about like writing a song or doing something with it. This idea of like this wallpaper that we live with. And if you take the time to do the inner work and bust through that wallpaper, it's really easy to bust through once you face it. Then I think that's where our creativity and our potential and ultimately our gifts are. And I tend to like sound like a utopian person, but I do believe that that's the key, is if every single one of us truly understood what our gifts were to share and to give to the world, then I think most of our problems would be solved.
Yeah, it gives you value and it gives you the ability to value others. And I love that that wallpaper thing. That's going to come up in my week. I'm going to be like, wallpaper.
Yeah.
My friend coined it the big wallpaper conspiracy.
Oh.
It's
an official thing.
Yeah. Hashtag.
Trademarked by your friend.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It's a long hashtag.
I know.
Hashtag, yeah. You know, there's some long hashtags out there.
There are. That's true.
They're getting longer.
I know. I'm guilty of making long hashtags because I'll listen to my shows and be like hashtag dreams, hashtag whatever, but sometimes I like have like a whole sentence. I'm like hashtag blah blah blah. Like last week my guest was like, if it's on the shelf, don't write that. And so that was one of my hashtags. I was like, that's long. Whatever. I didn't understand hashtags for a long time, but
I still kind of, I'm in and out with hashtags.
It's ridiculous. It's like on Instagram when you like see a picture and you're like, oh, what a lovely picture. And you look down and there's 800 hashtags and you're like, okay.
They only really matter at the very top or like for you.
Yeah. You're like, I coined this hashtag.
Yeah.
Well, and I get performance anxiety with hashtags.
You're like, what if I do it wrong?
Sometimes I'm about to do it, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know if this is right.
Oh, how funny.
See, that's funny because since, like, a lot of my friends on Facebook and Twitter are comedians, right? So most of the times the hashtags we do are just, they're just tags to the joke.
And also making fun of hashtags.
Yeah, they're all ironic. They're almost all ironic. In fact, it's less cool. If you're a comedian, you do, like, a sincere hashtag, you're not cool.
You're like
it's just something not cool about it. You just have to be ironic all the time. But, yeah.
Awesome. We have about 10 minutes left. Can you believe it?
Mm-hmm. Flew by.
The time flies when you're having fun conversations. Oh, wow. I've discovered. It's funny because I have anxiety every week when I start my show.
Like it's hard to start
that
shows.
First couple minutes. I'm like, and I feel like I've never done this before.
Yeah.
And then it gets smoother, and then I'm like, oh, la la la. Okay, we're 5 minutes in, and like time goes really slow. And then I start talking, and I'm like, oh, it's done. Whoops. So I love ending my shows with a sort of rapid fire series of questions, and we can maybe get through a few of them, maybe just a couple. I'm fine having it be a long conversation, or having your answer be, I don't know.
Okay.
Sound like fun?
Sure.
You guys ready? Okay. What book have you not gotten around to reading?
Brave New World.
Brave New World.
War and Peace.
I haven't read War and Peace. I have read Brave New World.
I did a podcast about it, and I haven't read it. To be fair, that's the point of the podcast, but also it's pretty great.
So what was your angle?
So it's a comedy podcast, and it's called Let's Read Together. And the whole point is we review books that we haven't read.
I just really love the strong main character in this.
That's
this
literally
piece.
What it is. We just made stuff up, but vaguely, because neither of us have read it. So,
and do you like have a synopsis that you're toying with? Or?
Yeah, my friend, he'll read the back of the book,
oh,
and
God.
Then he'll just be like,
"Go from there."
Yeah, it's weird that one part when she did the thing. Oh man,
and the ending, man, didn't
oh, it's
see
crazy.
That coming.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah. But I really want to read it though.
It's one of those like it kind of formed with the dystopian type novels that are coming out today. Where I think rooted back into that.
Yeah,
I get that one in 1984 mixed up in my head.
Yeah. I actually read 1984.
I haven't read 1984,
and I love 1984. But
so you
yeah.
probably I don't know. Maybe it's like one of those things you've read one or the other. I wonder if that's a thing.
I wonder
maybe.
People have
like the Stones or the Beatles. You're only into one.
Yeah.
Aldous Huxley. I read this somewhere that he wrote a letter to George Orwell and was like, my book is right. It's going to happen the way I said. Which I think he's right, though. Even though I haven't read Brave New World, I think he's probably...
I have really strong feelings.
From what I've heard.
That this is going to be...
Because 1984 is like a little too...
Oh, my gosh.
It's like a little... Like, it probably wouldn't happen
heavy.
That way. Yeah, it's
well,
like really...
Well, I mean, Margaret Atwood, are you guys aficionados? I mentioned her earlier. I'm a big fan. She has a trilogy that's kind of a similar vein, but, you know, her take of it. And people... you know, we'll say, like, where did you get these ideas? And she's like, they're not ideas. This is science. Like, this is really happening out in the world. Like, these mm-hmm. are real things. Like, her brother fact checks everything that she writes and makes sure that, like, the science is there that this could happen
mm-hmm.
or is happening, which is crazy to me.
Yeah.
Anyways, what book do you remember your parents reading to? You mentioned one.
Mm-hmm. Hope for the Flowers.
Any others
your parents
that
reading
stand
to
out?
You?
Yeah.
Trina Paulus.
Mm-hmm.
That was my favorite one.
If You Give a Mouse a Cookie.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's a classic.
Yeah.
I don't think I've answered this question. I remember this beautifully illustrated story of The Little Mermaid that was like the real Ooh. Story where she becomes seafoam. And then
she
I...
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then Disney came out and I was like, what the fuck? Like, that's not
she
what
does
happened.
Not become foam.
Yeah.
Do you have any rituals or routines related to reading or writing?
I was just talking to Lawson. I'm about to start another one because I basically was for a while having like 2 hours in the morning to read before I started my day. But I have gotten too busy to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So I've decided Sundays are going to be the day that I wake up and I can stay in bed and read for about 3 or 4 hours.
Yay!
Yeah.
I love carving out precious time for nothing.
Yeah.
My friends will be like, are you busy? I'm like, yep. Yeah. All night. And they're like, what are you doing? And you're like, busy. Like, I don't know what I'll end up doing. I might end up painting, but like, that's my date night with myself. Like, guard it with my life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Keeps me sane.
The closest I've come to a ritual, besides like with the writing pages, is...
For 1 week.
Yeah.
It was
a
really great week.
Good time. It was such
Highly
a good
recommend
week.
It.
Oh, man. It was such a good week. I'm about to go to sleep, and then I'll just be pummeled with a bunch of ideas.
The ideas come.
And then I'll be like, is that really that funny, though? Should I get up? Because I really would like to go to sleep now.
That's
and then I get up and write for, like, late at night.
Yeah, having a notebook by your bed. Or also, this is where technology, I like, yay, voice to text or, like, a voice recorder. You can be like, I just had this really random thought and blah, 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 blah. Okay, bye. And then, like, 4 months later, you're listening to all these, and you're like, oh...
Yeah.
Let me use that.
Yeah.
So I've noticed that people sometimes have a book that transitioned them from child to like teenagers. Like during puberty, there's like a book that changed you, like made you feel things or think about things differently. Is there a book that did that for you?
I'm embarrassed to say it was Danielle Steele.
Danielle Steele. Mine was Clan of the Cave Bear.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was like, wow, this is... mature.
Wait, what's Danielle Steele?
She's like a romance novelist.
Oh, okay.
Really, really, really. Okay. I think that before that I was reading like Ramona Quimby.
She like
Quimbley
kind of
stuff.
Defined her own genre of romance.
Did she?
I feel like because it's like she's her own person and she has like 8 million books.
I'm telling you, I read all of them from the time I was like 14 to like 18 and that was it. That's all I read.
Wow.
But she got me reading because before that, like I said, I just never connected with that many books.
Mm.
And especially as a preteen.
And that was me with, I was Mormon as a teenager. It was an act of rebellion. But, like, Mormon romance novels was my total guilty pleasure. Like, such a strange niche.
Yeah,
there's a lot of, like, Mormon-themed romance novels.
Wow, that's,
no
yeah.
that's great.
And there's even a couple movies out about them, so it's funny. How do you find the books that you read now?
I go to a lot of used bookstores and kind of just see things that pop out.
Yeah, that's a good way to do. I usually, for me, recommendations.
Yeah.
That's a good way.
Yeah.
If we were to go to your house right now, what books would be showcased? Like Eye Level or Out on the Coffee Table?
Catch 22.
I haven't read.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's my favorite book.
I always meant to. I think
By a
you
lot.
Told me to read that one.
I have so many books that I'm like, oh, people keep telling me to read that.
Yeah. Also, yeah, Brave New World also. That'd be just out there. Just hasn't been opened.
Oh, goodness. You have the book?
Yeah. That's the worst part. I've had it for like 5 years.
That's why I eventually started getting rid of books that I didn't read that I was just like hoarding because I'm like, there's libraries and...
But I know I'm going to read it someday.
I know I'm going to read all these books that people recommend to me, yeah. But... I can't, like, for some reason, I can't sink my teeth into them, or it's I'm not ready to have that conversation, or I get bored with the writing. I don't know.
I did start it, like, twice. I started it, but yeah.
Have you ever tried audiobooks?
I have. Not with Brave New World specifically, but for, like, comedians will write books, and I'll listen to it
because it's their voice. That's something I've gotten more into lately that I used to be pretty, like, against. But there is something about that voice. And for me, also, like, articulation. I'm like, oh, that's how that word's pronounced. So, like, I was totally wrong in my mind.
Yeah.
What is the best writing advice? Oh, is there any books showcased in your place?
I have a whole lot of books on, like, spirituality.
Mm.
And then... And just
we're talking about, like, more, like, Buddhist-ish Zen?
More, like, or? New Age.
Okay.
It's sort of, like, pulling from all those traditions, but people that aren't identifying with any one religion anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And just the idea of, like... And then I'm also reading, like, a Bill Evans biography right now. You know, Bill Evans, the pianist.
Okay.
So those are the... And I was thinking, too, you know, one of the main ways... One of the things I love about Brooklyn is I get a lot of books because somebody left it out on a
stoop. Yeah, on the stoops. Right? It's stoop shopping, man. Around,
especially in my neighborhood, yeah.
There's been some, like, really great ones that I found that way.
Yeah. Well, we are running to the end of our show. Empty Orchestra is next, exploring the dynamic relationship between song, singer, in the context of karaoke with Angelica and Amanda. You've been listening to Ink and Worm, All Things Reading and Writing, and we had Lyndall Descant and, oh my gosh, my brain, Lawson Leon.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And thanks for joining us. Find me, I'm on all the socials, and I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it, trenchant.